Russian researchers in the late 1940s kept five people awake for 15 days using an experimental gas-based stimulant. They were kept in a sealed environment to carefully monitor their oxygen intake so the gas wouldn't kill them, since it was toxic. This was before closed-circuit cameras, so they had only microphones and 5-inch-thick portal-sized windows into the chamber to monitor them. The chamber was stocked with books, cots to sleep on, but no bedding, running water, a toilet, and enough dried food to last all five of them for over a month. The test subjects were political prisoners deemed enemies of the state during World War II. Everything was fine for the first 5 days. The subjects hardly complained, having been promised falsely that they would be freed if they submitted to the test, and did not sleep for 30 days. Their conversations and activities were monitored, and it was noted that they continued to talk about increasingly traumatic incidents in their past, and the general tone of their conversations took on a darker aspect after the 4-day mark. After 5 days, they started to complain about the circumstances and events that led them to where they were, and started to demonstrate severe paranoia. They stopped talking to each other and began alternately whispering into the microphones in one-way mirrored portals. Oddly, they all seemed to think that they could win the trust of the experimenters by turning over their comrades, the other subjects in captivity, with them. At first, the researchers suspected this was an effect of the gas itself. After 9 days, the first of them started screaming. He ran the length of the chamber, repeatedly yelling at the top of his lungs for 3 hours straight. He continued attempting to scream, but was only able to produce occasional squeaks. The researchers postulated that he had physically torn his vocal cords. The most surprising thing about this behavior is how the other captives reacted to it, or rather, didn't react to it. They continued whispering to the microphones until the second of the captives started to scream. The two non-screaming captives took the books apart, smeared page after page with their own feces, and pasted them calmly over the glass portals. Screaming promptly stopped. So did the whispering to the microphones. After 3 more days passed, the researchers checked the microphones hourly to make sure they were working, since they thought it impossible that no sound could be coming with the 5 people inside. The oxygen consumption in the chamber indicated that all 5 must still be alive. In fact, it was the amount of oxygen 5 people would consume at a very heavy level of strenuous exercise. On the morning of the 14th day, the researchers did something they said they would not do to get the reaction from the captives. They used the intercom inside the chamber, hoping to provoke any response from the captives. They were afraid were either dead or vegetables. They announced, "We are opening the chamber to test the microphones. Step away from the door and lie flat on the floor, or you will be shot. Compliance will earn one of you your immediate freedom." To their surprise, they heard a single phrase and a calm voice response, "We no longer want to be freed." Debate broke out among the researchers and the military forces funding the research. Unable to provoke any more response using the intercom, it was finally decided to open the chamber at midnight on the 15th day. The chamber was flushed of the stimulant gas and filled with fresh air, and immediately voices from the microphones began to object. 3 different voices began begging, as if pleading for the life of loved ones, to turn the gas back on. The chamber was opened and soldiers sent in to retrieve the test subjects. They began to scream louder than ever, and so did the soldiers when they saw what was inside. 4 of the 5 subjects were still alive, although no one could rightly call the state of any of them life. The food rations past day 5 had not been so much as touched. There were chunks of meat from the dead test subject's thighs and chest stuffed into the drain in the center of the chamber, blocking the drain and allowing 4 inches of water to accumulate on the floor. Precisely how much water on the floor was actual blood was never determined. All 4 surviving test subjects also had large portions of muscle and skin torn away from their bodies. The destruction of flesh and exposed bone on their fingertips indicated that the wounds were inflicted by hand, not with teeth, as the researchers initially thought. Closer examination of the position and angles of the wounds indicated that most, if not all, of them were self-inflicted. The abdominal organs below the rib cage of all 4 test subjects had been removed. While the heart, lungs, and diaphragm remained in place, the skin and most of the muscles attached to the ribs had been ripped off, exposing the lungs through the rib cage. All the blood vessels and organs remained intact. They had just been taken out and laid on the floor, fanning around the still living bodies of the subjects. The digestive tract of all 4 could be seen to be working, digesting food. It quickly became apparent that what they were digesting was their own flesh that they had ripped off and eaten over the course of the days. Most of the soldiers were Russian special operatives at the facility, but still many refused to return to the chamber to remove the test subjects. They continued to scream to be left in the chamber, and ultimately begged and demanded that the gas be turned back on, lest they fall asleep. To everyone's surprise, the test subjects put up a fierce fight in the process of being removed from the chamber. Another was gravely injured by having his testicles ripped off and an artery in his leg severed by one of the subject's teeth. Another 5 of the soldiers lost their lives, if you count ones that committed suicide in the weeks following the incident. In the struggle, one of the 4 living subjects had his spleen ruptured and he bled out almost immediately. The medical researchers attempted to sedate him, but this proved impossible. He was injected with more than 10 times the human dose of morphine and still fought like a cornered animal, breaking the ribs and arm of one of the doctors. When his heart was seen to beat for a full 2 minutes after he had bled out, this led to a point where there was more air in his system than blood. Even after it stopped, he continued to scream and flail for another 3 minutes, struggling to attack anyone in reach, and just repeated the word "more" over and over, weaker and weaker, until he finally fell silent. The surviving 3 test subjects were heavily restrained and moved to a medical facility. The 2 with intact vocal cords continuously begging for the gas, demanding to be kept awake. The most injured of the 3 was taken to the only surgical operating room in the facility. In the process of preparing the subject to have his organs placed back within his body, it was found that he was effectively immune to the sedative they had given him to prepare him for the surgery. He fought furiously against the restraints when the aesthetic gas was brought out to put him under. He managed to tear most of the way through a 4-inch-wide leather strap on his wrist, even through the weight of a 200-pound soldier holding him down. It took only a little more anesthetic than normal to put him under, and the instant his eyelids fluttered and closed, his heart stopped. In the autopsy of the test subject that died on the operating table, it was found that his blood had tripled the normal level of oxygen. His muscles that were still attached to his skeleton were badly torn, and he had broken 9 bones in his struggle to not be subdued. Most of them were from the force his own muscles had exerted on them. The second survivor had been the first of a group of 5 to start screaming. His vocal cords destroyed, he was unable to beg or object to surgery, and he only reacted by shaking his head violently in disapproval when the anesthetic gas was brought near him. He shook his head yes when someone suggested, reluctantly, that they try surgery without anesthetic, and did not react for the entire 6-hour procedure of replacing his abdominal organs and attempting to cover them with what remained of his skin. The surgeon proceeding stated repeatedly that it should be medically impossible for the patient to still be alive. One terrified nurse assisting the surgery stated that she had seen the patient's mouth curl into a smile several times whenever his eyes met hers. When the surgery ended, the subject looked at the surgeon and began to wheeze loudly, attempting to talk while struggling. Assuming this must be something of a drastic importance, the surgeon had a pen and pad fetched so the patient could write his message. It simply said, "Keep cutting." The other two test subjects were given the same surgery, both without anesthetic as well. Once paralyzed, the subjects could only follow the attending researchers with their eyes. The paralytic cleared their system in an abnormally short period of time, and they were soon trying to escape their bonds. The moment they could speak, they were again asking for the stimulant gas. The researchers tried asking why they had injured themselves, why they had ripped out their own guts, and why they wanted to be given the gas again. Only one response was given. "I must remain awake." All three subjects' restraints were reinforced, and they were placed back into the chamber, awaiting determination as to what should be done with them. The researchers, facing the wrath of their military benefactors for having failed the stated goals of their project, considered euthanizing the surviving subjects. The commanding officer, an ex-KGB, instead saw potential and wanted to see what would happen if they were put back on the gas. The researchers strongly objected, but were overruled. In preparation for being sealed into the chamber again, the subjects were connected to an EEG monitor and had their restraints padded for long-term confinement. To everyone's surprise, all three stopped struggling the moment it let slip that they were going back on the gas. It was obvious at this point all three were putting up a great struggle to stay awake. One of the subjects that could speak was humming loudly and continuously. The mute subject was straining his legs against the leather bonds with all his might, first left, then right, then left again, for something to focus on. The remaining subject was holding his head off the pillow and blinking rapidly. Having been the first to be wired for EEG, most of the researchers were monitoring his brain waves in surprise. They were normal, most of the time, but sometimes flatlined inexplicably. It looked as if they were repeatedly suffering brain death before returning to normal. As they focused on paper scrolling out of the brainwave monitor, only one nurse saw his eyes slip shut. At the same moment, his head hit the pillow. His brainwaves immediately changed to that of deep sleep, then flatlined for the last time as his heart simultaneously stopped. The only remaining subject that could speak started screaming to be sealed in now. His brainwave showed the same flat lines as one who had just died from falling asleep. The commander gave the order to seal the chamber with both subjects inside, as well as three researchers. One of the named three immediately drew his gun and shot the commander point blank between his eyes, then turned the gun to the mute subject and blew his brains out as well. He pointed the gun at the remaining subject, still restrained to the bed. He pointed the gun at his re- He pointed his gun at the remaining subject, still restrained to a bed, as the remaining members of the medical and research team fled the room. "I won't be locked in here with these things. Not with you," he screamed at the man strapped to the table. "What are you?" he demanded. "I must know." The subject smiled. "Have you forgotten so easily?" the subject asked. "We are you. We are the madness that lurks within you all, begging to be free at every moment in your deepest animal mind. We are what you hide from in your beds every night. We are what you sedate into silence and paralyze when you go into nocturnal haven, where we cannot tread." The researcher paused and aimed at the subject's head. The researcher paused, then aimed at the subject's heart and fired. The EEG flatlined as the subject weakly choked out. "So nearly free."
Have you ever been influenced by clothing? I don't mean confidence or looks. Have you ever been given more control than ever by an item or a truth or just a favorite shirt? Have you ever been influenced in the worst possible way by showing the truth? The following is taken directly from journal entries. The entries were written by a notorious but unknown killer. He is notorious in that this means that everybody has seen his work. He is unknown because nobody knows that he has done it. His origin is unusual. No troubles, no evil family, no magic, no paranormal forces. His life was chosen by him and him alone. His identity is also unknown. He will be named from here on as the Hooded Man. April 3rd, 2004. It's been really cold around here. I don't have anything really to cover myself. All I have are my t-shirt and jeans. So today I decided to get a jacket. I was just in a local store, nothing special. It's a black hoodie with a white lining. I think it looks pretty cool, and when I tried it on, the attendant said it suits me just fine. I said thanks to be polite. Common courtesy is so hard to find. So, I bought it. I haven't taken it off yet. Not only is it warm, but I can really see myself doing amazing things in it. When I look in the mirror, I smirk. I feel amazing. I can't really explain it, but I like it. I really like it. I feel the need to put my hood up. Something about the hood has a way of making me just feel more confident. Not just more confident, but just more everything. I don't know how to explain it. Even though it shows their face, it hides something somewhere. Anyway, it's really late now. I've been feeling great all day, but it's time to go to bed. Time kind of just flew by. It's kind of strange. I'll have to explain more tomorrow. April 10th. I've had a hell of a week. I felt so great. I walked the halls like a big shot. I'm sure I looked smug, but hey, I felt confident, alright? That's why Jack challenged me, though. He was so angry. Who never do ignoring, as insult was more insulting than responding with shrewd comments about someone's family. He antagonized me. He asked for it. He threw a hard punch, and I stood. I swung harder than ever before when I actually argued with him. I felt so cool all week. My confidence kept me up. I punched him hard in the stomach, and I lifted him up with an underhook. It felt so good. It really did.
14th. Jack still isn't out of the hospital. They said he's in a lot of pain. He spit up a lot of blood when I hit him. His parents told me over the phone. I reflected on it, on how great it felt when my fist connected, how his scream sounded. "That's good to hear," I said blankly. "I don't care about Jack." I smiled at his pain. I kept staring into the mirror. I'm always wearing my favorite hoodie. It feels so empowering. My friends would laugh at what I say. They would compare me to Spider-Man in his black suit. Spider-Man threw his power away. I don't plan on doing anything with my source of confidence. April 22nd. Jack has gone to a better place. The words rang through my ears. He's dead. He lost too much blood. His father told me the day that I visited that he was losing blood due to a personal health condition. But the way his mother looked at me told me the real story. I had killed him. I still remember the satisfaction of hitting him. I never wanted to kill him. I need to think about what I've done, right? That'll fix my feelings. But what is there to think about? Regret is a foolish emotion. I don't need regret. April 24th. Dad has been avoiding me lately, and Mom just tells me that she loves me. They both want me to feel endless guilt, but I won't, or rather, I can't. I can fake it for the public, but the truth is, I'm not sorry. Spider-Man's story is starting to make me think more and more, but why would a curse or possessed hoodie land in my possession? Everybody who knew Jack glares at me now. Everyone who I would talk to have transferred themselves out of my class or went to a different school entirely. Teachers don't look at me much or get on to me if I'm breaking any rules. Today I threw a pencil at my history teacher. It hit his shoulder. He just froze for a second and continued what he was doing. Everyone either hates me or probably wants me dead, or they fear me. My writing is the only comfort I have. I can be at peace and let myself go. April 25th. They provoked me. They threatened me. I had no choice. They would have killed me. My hood protected my face. The knife naturally moved from Rob's hand to mine. I didn't mean to. The writing was short. April 30th. 5 days. 5 days being interrogated and sleeping in a cell. They decided I was only defending myself. I can hear Mom and Dad talking. They want me gone. They're both scared. I was an idiot to think that this jacket of mine was possessing me or changing my personality. It's just a really cool jacket. I remember how I put it up when Jack challenged me. I put it up when those guys tried to kill me. I feel worse. I feel indifferent. I am in control. I have finally come to realize insanity. I wanted to kill them, all of them. I needed only excerpt from a local newspaper. Ominous unknown killer still at large. After weeks of an unexplained murders, the ominous unknown killer is still on the rise. After little evidence has been found, a young boy states that he has survived one of the killer's attacks and bravely tells his story. I had a bad dream.
and I woke up in the middle of the night, says the boy. I saw that for some reason the window was open, even though I remember it being closed before I went to bed. I got up and shut it. Afterwards, I simply crawled under my covers and tried to get back to sleep. That's when I had a strange feeling like someone was watching me. I looked up and nearly jumped out of my bed. There, in the little ray of light illuminating from between my curtains, were a pair of two eyes. These weren't regular eyes, they were dark, ominous eyes. They were bordered in black and just plain out terrified me. That's when I saw his mouth. A long, horrendous smile that made every hair on my body stand up. The figure stood there, watching me. Finally, after what seemed like forever, he said a simple phrase, but said it in a way that only a madman could speak. He said, "Go to sleep." I let out a scream. That's what sent me at him. He pulled up a knife, aiming at my heart. He jumped on top of my bed. I fought back. I kicked. I punched. I rolled around, trying to knock him off me desperately. That's when my dad busted in. The man threw the knife. It went right into my dad's shoulder. The man probably could have finished me off if one of the neighbors hadn't alerted the police. They drove into the parking lot and ran towards the door. The man turned and ran down the hallway. I heard a smash like glass breaking. As I came out of my room, I saw that the window that was pointing towards the back of the house was broken. I looked out to see him vanish into the distance. I can tell you one thing. I will never forget that face. Those cold, evil eyes, that psychotic smile. They will never leave my head. Police are still on the look for this man. If you see anyone that fits the description in this story, please contact your local police department. Jeff and his family had just moved into a new neighborhood. His dad had gotten a promotion at work, and they thought it would be best to live in one of those fancy neighborhoods. Jeff and his brother, Lou, couldn't complain, though. A new, better house, what was not to love? As they were getting unpacked, one of their neighbors came by. "Hello," she said. "I'm Barbara. I live across the street from you. Well, I just wanted to introduce myself and to introduce my son." She turns around and calls her son over. "Billy, these are the new neighbors." Billy said hi and ran back to play in his yard. "Well," said Jeff's mom, "I'm Margaret. This is my husband, Peter, and my two sons, Jeff and Lou." They each introduced themselves, and then Barbara invited them to her son's birthday. Jeff and his brother were about to object when their mother said that they would love to. When Jeff and his family were done packing, Jeff went up to his mom. "Mom, why did you invite us to some kid's party? If you haven't noticed, I'm not some dumb kid." "Jeff," his mother said, "we just moved here. We should show that we want to spend time with our neighbors. Now, we're going to that party, and that's final." Jeff started to talk, but stopped himself, knowing that he couldn't do anything. Whenever his mom said something, it was final. He walked up to his room and plopped down on his bed. He sat there looking at his ceiling when suddenly he got a weird feeling. Not so much a pain, but a weird feeling. He dismissed it as just some random feeling. He heard his mother call him down to get his stuff, and he walked down to go get it. The next day, Jeff walked down the stairs to get breakfast and got ready for school. As he sat there, eating his breakfast, he once again got that feeling. This time it was stronger. It gave him a slight tugging pain. but he once again dismissed it. As he and Lou finished breakfast, they walked down to the bus stop. They sat there waiting for the bus, and then all of a sudden some kid on a skateboard jumped over them, only inches above their laps. They both jumped back in surprise. "Hey, what the hell?" The kid landed and turned back to them. He kicked his skateboard up and caught it in his hands. The kid seems to be about 12, 1 year younger than Jeff. He wears an Aeropostale shirt and ripped blue jeans. "Well, well, well. It looks like we got some new meat." Suddenly, two other kids appeared. One was super skinny, and the other was huge. "Well, since you're new here, I'd like to introduce ourselves. Over there is Keith." Jeff and Lou looked over to the skinny kid. He had a dopey face that you would expect a sidekick to have. "And he's Troy." They looked over at the fat kid. Talk about a tub of lard. This kid looked like he hadn't exercised since he was crawling. "And I," said the first kid, "am Randy. Now, for all the kids in this neighborhood, there is a small price for bus fare, if you catch my drift." Lou stood up, ready to punch the lights out of this kid's eyes, when one of his friends pulled a knife on him. "I had hoped you would be more cooperative, but it seems we must do this the hard way." The kid walked up to Lou and took his wallet out of his pocket. Jeff got that feeling again. Now it was truly strong, a burning sensation. He stood up, but Lou gestured to sit down. Jeff ignored him and walked up to the kid. "Listen here, you little punk. Get back my bro's wallet or else." Randy put the wallet in his pocket and pulled out his own knife. "Oh, and what will you do?" Just as he finished his sentence, Jeff popped the kid in the nose. As Randy reached for his face, Jeff grabbed the kid's wrist and broke it. Randy screamed and Jeff grabbed the knife from his hand. Troy and Keith rushed Jeff, but Jeff was too quick. He threw Randy to the ground. Keith lashed out at him, but Jeff ducked and stabbed the kid in the arm. Keith dropped his knife and fell to the ground, screaming. Troy rushed him too, but Jeff didn't even need the knife. He punched Troy straight in the stomach, and Troy went down. As he fell, he puked all over. Lou could do nothing but look in amazement at Jeff. "Jeff, how did you..." That was all he said. They saw the bus coming and knew that they'd be blamed for the whole thing, so they started running as fast as they could. As they ran, they looked back and saw the bus driver rushing over to Randy and the others. As Jeff and Lou made it to school, they didn't dare tell what happened. All they did was sit and listen. Lou just thought of that as his brother beating up a few kids, but Jeff knew it was more. It was something scary. As he got that feeling, he felt how powerful it was, the urge to just hurt someone. He didn't like how it sounded, but he couldn't help feeling happy. He felt that strange feeling go away and stay away for the entire day of school. Even as he walked home, due to the whole thing near the bus stop and how now he probably wouldn't be taking the bus anymore, he felt happy. When he got home, his parents asked him how his day was, and he said in a somewhat ominous voice, "It was a wonderful day." Next morning, he heard a knock at his front door. He walked down to find two police officers at the door, his mother looking back at him with an angry look. "Jeff, these officers tell me that you attacked three kids, that it wasn't a regular fighting, that they were stabbed. Stabbed, son." Jeff's gaze fell to the floor, showing his mother that it was true. "Mom, they were the ones who pulled the knives on me and Lou." "Son," said one of the cops, "we found three kids, two stabbed, one having a bruise on his stomach, and we have witnesses proving that you fled the scene. Now, what does that tell us?" Jeff knew it was no use. He could say him and Lou had been attacked, but there was no proof. It was not them who attacked first. They couldn't say that they weren't fleeing the scene of the crime because, truth be told, they were. So Jeff couldn't defend himself or Lou. Son, call down your brother. Jeff couldn't do it, since it was him who beat up all those kids. Sir, it was me. I was the one who beat up those kids. Lou tried to hold me back, but he couldn't stop me. The cop looked at his partner, and they both nodded. Well, kid, looks like it'll be a year in juvie. Wait, says Lou. They all looked up, seeing him holding a knife. The officers pulled their guns and locked them on Lou. It was me. I beat up those little punks. Have the marks to prove it. He lifted up his sleeves to reveal cuts and bruises, as if he was in a struggle. Son, put the knife down now, said the officer. Lou held up the knife and dropped it to the ground. He put his hands up and walked over to the cops. No, Lou, it was me. I did it. Jeff had tears streaming down his face. Huh, poor bro. Trying to take the blame for what I did. Well, take me away. The police led Lou to the patrol car. Lou, tell them it was me. Tell them. I was the one who beat up those kids. Jeff's mother put her hands on his shoulders. Jeff, please, you don't have to lie. We know it's Lou. You can stop. Jeff watched helplessly as the cop car speeds off with Lou inside. A few minutes later, Jeff's dad pulled into the driveway, seeing Jeff's face and knowing something was wrong. Son, what is it? Jeff couldn't answer. His vocal cords were strained from crying. Instead, Jeff's mother walked over to his father and broke the bad news to him as Jeff wept in the driveway. After an hour or so, Jeff walked back to the house, seeing that his parents are both shocked, sad, and disappointed. He couldn't look at them. He couldn't see how they thought of Lou when it was all his fault. He just went to sleep, trying to get the whole thing off of his mind. 2 days went by with no word from Lou at the JDC. No friends to hang out with. Nothing but sadness and guilt. That is, until Saturday, when Jeff was woken up by his mother with a happy, sunshiny face. Jeff, it's the day, she said as she opened up the curtains to let light flood into the room. What? What's today? Asked Jeff as he stirs awake. Why, it's Billy's birthday party. He was now fully awake. Mom, you're joking, right? You don't expect me to go to some kid's party after... There was a long pause. Jeff, we both know what happened. I think this party could be the thing that brightens up the past days. Now, get dressed. Jeff's mother walked out of the room and downstairs to get ready herself. He fought himself to get up. He picked out a random shirt and a pair of jeans. He walked down the stairs. He saw his mother and father all dressed up. His mother in a dress and his father in a suit. He thought, why did they ever wear such fancy clothes to a kid's party? Son, that's all you're gonna wear? Jeff's mom said. Better than wearing too much, he said. His mother pushed down the feeling to yell at him and hit it with a smile. Now, Jeff, we may be overdressed, but this is how you go if you want to make an impression, said his father. Jeff grunted and went back up to his room. I don't have any fancy clothes, he yelled down the stairs. Just pick out something, called his mother. He looked around in his closet for what he could call fancy. He found a pair of black dress pants that he had for special occasions and an undershirt. He couldn't find a shirt to go with it, though. He looked around and only found striped and patterned shirts, none of which would go with the dress pants. Finally, he found a white hoodie and put it on. You're wearing that? They both said. His mother looked at her watch. Oh, no time to change. Let's just go, she said as she hurried Jeff and his father out the door. They crossed the street over to Barbara and Billy's house. They knocked on the door, and at it appeared that Barbara, just like his parents, was way overdressed. As they walked inside, all Jeff could see were adults, no kids. The kids are out in the yard, Jeff. How about you go and meet some of them, said Barbara. Jeff walked outside to a yard full of kids. They were running around in weird cowboy costumes and shooting each other with plastic guns. You might as well be standing in a Toys R Us. Suddenly, a kid came up to him and handed him a toy gun and a hat. "Hey, wanna play?" he said. No, kid, I'm way too old for this stuff." The kid looked at him with a weird puppy dog face. "Please?" said the kid. "Fine," said Jeff. He put on the hat and started to pretend to shoot at the kids. At first, he thought it was totally ridiculous, but then he started to have actually a little bit of fun. It might not have been cool or anything, but it was the first time he had done something to take his mind off of Lou, so he played with the kids for a while, until he heard a noise, a weird rolling noise, and it hit him. Randy, Troy, and Keith all jumped over the fence on their skateboards. Jeff dropped the fake gun and ripped off the hat. Randy looked at Jeff with burning hatred. "Hello, Jeff, is it?" he said. "We have some unfinished business." Jeff saw his bruised nose. "I think we're even. I beat the crap out of you, and you got my brother sent to JDC. Randy got an angry look in his eyes. "Oh no, I don't go for even. I go for winning. You may have kicked our asses that one day, but not today." As he said that, Randy pushed at Jeff. They both fell to the ground. Randy punched Jeff in the nose, and Jeff grabbed him by the ears and headbutted him. Jeff pushed Randy off of him, and both rose to their feet. Kids were screaming, parents were running out of the house. Troy and Keith both pulled guns out of their pockets. "No one interrupts or guts will fly," they said. Randy pulled the knife on Jeff and stabbed it into his shoulder. Jeff screamed and fell to his knees. Randy started kicking him in the face. After three kicks, Jeff grabbed his foot and twisted it. It caused Randy to fall to the ground. Jeff stood up and walked towards the back door. Troy grabbed him. "Need some help?" He picks up Jeff by the back of the collar and throws him to the patio door. As Jeff tries to stand, he is kicked down to the ground. Randy repeatedly starts kicking Jeff until he starts to cough up blood. "Come on, Jeff, fight me." He picks up Jeff and throws him into the kitchen. Randy sees a bottle of vodka on the counter and smashes the glass over Jeff's head. "Fight!" He throws Jeff back into the living room. "Come on, Jeff, look at me." Jeff glances up, his face riddled with blood. "I was the one who got your brother sent to JDC, and now you're just gonna sit there and let him rot in there for a whole year? You should be ashamed." Jeff starts to get up. "Oh, finally, you stand and fight." Jeff is now on his feet, blood and vodka on his face. Once again, Jeff gets that strange feeling, the one in which he hasn't felt for a while. "Finally, he's up," says Randy as he runs at Jeff. That's when it happens. Something inside Jeff snaps. His psyche is destroyed. All rational thinking is gone. All he can do is kill. He grabs Randy and pile drives him into the ground. He gets on top of him and punches him straight in the heart. The punch causes Randy's heart to stop. As Randy gasps for air, Jeff hammers down on him, punch after punch. Blood gushes from Randy's body until he takes one final breath and dies. Everyone is looking at Jeff now. The parents, the crying kids, even Troy and Keith. Although they easily break from their gaze and point their guns at Jeff, Jeff sees the guns trained on him and runs for the stairs. As he runs, Troy and Keith let fire on him, each shooting and missing. Jeff runs up the stairs. He hears Troy and Keith follow up behind. As they let out their final rounds of bullets, Jeff ducks into the bathroom. He grabs the towel rack and rips it off the wall. Troy and Keith race in, knives ready. Troy swings his knife at Jeff, who backs away and bangs the towel rack into Troy's face. Troy goes down hard, and now all that's left is Keith. He is more agile than Troy, though. He ducks when Jeff swings the towel rack. He dropped the knife and grabbed Jeff by the neck. He pushed him into the wall. A tub of bleach fell down on top of them from the top shelf. It burnt both of them. They both started to scream. Jeff wiped his eyes as best as he could. He pulled back the towel rack and swung it straight into Keith's head. As he lay there, bleeding, he let out an ominous smile. "What's so funny?" asked Jeff. Keith pulled out a lighter and switched it on. "What's funny," he said, "is that you're covered in bleach and alcohol." Jeff's eyes widened as Keith threw the lighter at him. As soon as the flame made contact with him, the flames ignited the alcohol and the vodka. While the alcohol burned him, the bleach bleached his skin. Jeff let out a terrible screech as he caught on fire. He tried to whirl out the fire, but it was no use. The alcohol made him a walking inferno. He ran down the hall, fell down the stairs. Everyone started to scream as they saw Jeff, now a man on fire, dropped to the ground, nearly dead. The last thing Jeff saw was his mother and other parents trying to extinguish the flames. That's when he passed out. When Jeff woke, he had a cast wrapped around his face. He couldn't see anything, but he felt a cast on his shoulder and stitches all over his body. He tried to stand up, but he realized that there was some tube in his arm, and when he tried to get up, it fell out, and a nurse rushed in. "I don't think you can get out of bed just yet," she said as she put him back in his bed and reinserted the tube. Jeff sat there with no vision, no idea of his surroundings. Finally, after hours, he heard his mother. "Honey, are you okay?" she asked. Jeff couldn't answer, though. His face was covered, and he was unable to speak. "Oh, honey, I have great news. After all the witnesses told the police that Randy confessed to trying to attack you, they decided to let Lou go." This made Jeff almost bolt up, stopping halfway, remembering the tube coming out of his arm. "He'll be out by tomorrow, and then you two will be able to be together again." Jeff's mother hugs Jeff and says her goodbyes. The next couple of weeks were those where Jeff was visited by his family. Then came the day where his bandages were to be removed. His family were all there to see it, what he would look like. As the doctors unwrapped the bandages from Jeff's face, everyone was on the edge of their seats. They waited until the last bandage holding the cover of his face was almost removed. "Let's hope for the best," said the doctor. He quickly pulls the cloth, letting the rest fall from Jeff's face. Jeff's mother screams at the sight of his face. Lou and Jeff's dad were awestruck. "What? What happened to my face?" Jeff said. He rushed out of the bed and ran to the bathroom. He looked in the mirror and saw the cause of the distress, his face. It was horrible. His lips were burnt into a deep shade of red. His face was turned into a pure white color, and his hair singed from brown to black. He slowly put his hand on his face. It had a sort of leathery feel to it. He looked back at his family, and then back at the mirror. "Jeff," Lou said, "it's not that bad." "Not that bad?" said Jeff. "It's perfect." His family were equally surprised. Jeff started laughing uncontrollably. His parents noticed that his left eye and hand were twitching.
Jeff, are you okay?"
"Okay. I've never felt more happy. Look at me. His face goes perfectly with me." He couldn't stop laughing. He stroked his face, feeling it, looking at it in the mirror. What caused this? Well, you may recall that when Jeff was fighting Randy, something in his mind, his sanity, snapped. Now he was left as a crazy killing machine. That is, his parents didn't know, though.
Doctor? Said Jeff's mom. "Is my son all right? You know, in the head?"
Yes. His behavior is typical for patients that have taken very large amount of painkillers.
If his behavior doesn't change in a few weeks, bring him back here and we'll give him a psychological test.
Oh, thank you, doctor. Jeff's mother went over to Jeff. Jeff, sweetie, it's time to go.
Jeff looks away from the mirror, his face still formed into a crazy smile.
Okay, mommy.
His mother took him by the shoulder and took him to get his clothes. This is what he came in with, said the lady at the desk. Jeff's mom looked down to see the black dress pants and white hoodie her son wore. Now they were clean of blood and stitched back together. Jeff's mother led him to his room and made him put on his clothes. Then they left, not knowing that this was their final day of life. Later that night, Jeff's mother woke up to a sound coming from the bathroom. Slowly walked over to see what it was. When she looked into the bathroom, she saw a horrendous sight. Jeff had taken a knife and carved a smile into his cheeks.
Jeff, what are you doing?
Asked his mother. Jeff looked over to his mother. I couldn't keep smiling, Mommy. It hurt after a while. Now I can smile forever. Jeff's mother noticed his eyes ringed in black.
Jeff, your eyes.
His eyes were seemingly never closing. I couldn't see my face. I got tired, and my eyes started to close. I burned off my eyelashes. I burned out the eyelids so I could forever see myself, my new face. Jeff's mother slowly started to back away, seeing that her son was going insane. What's wrong, Mommy? Aren't I beautiful?
Yes, son, she said. You are. Let me go get your father and so he can see your face.
She ran into the room and shook Jeff's dad from his sleep.
Honey, go get the gun,
She stopped as she saw Jeff in the doorway holding a knife.
Mommy, you lied.
That's the last thing they hear as Jeff rushes them with the knife, gutting them both. His brother Lou woke up, startled by the noise. He didn't hear anything else, so he just shut his eyes and tried to go back to sleep. As he was on the border of slumber, he got the strangest feeling that someone was watching him. He looked up before Jeff's hand covered his mouth. He slowly raised the knife, ready to plunge it into Lou. Lou thrashed, trying desperately to escape Jeff's grip.
Shh. Just go to sleep.